ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Welcome to Arts in 30, your weekly wrap of global news in arts and culture. Daniel Browning with you. Last year, the actor Blake Lively accused her co-star Justin Baldoni of inappropriate conduct on the set of their film It Ends With Us. That's led to lawsuits and counter-lawsuits, but it's also created a cottage industry of influencers with very strong opinions about the cases, and particularly about Blake Lively. We'll be looking at how celebrities are using social media to shape public opinion, and why women tend to get caught in the crosshairs. But first, the news headlines with Skye Kirkham. Now, Skye, Creative Australia's announced the terms of reference for the external review around their decision to first appoint and then unceremoniously dump Khalid Zabsabi for the 2026 Venice Biennale.
They have, Daniel. The board has announced that they have selected the firm Blackhall & Pearl to conduct the review, which will look into the governance and decision-making process around the 26 Biennale. To quote from the terms of reference, they will review the governance and decision-making processes and procedures undertaken by Creative Australia, including its board, by which the artistic team was selected to represent Australia at the Venice Biennale 2026 and associated decisions. Now, a statement from Creative Australia has confirmed that the review will consider the board's decision not to proceed with the artistic team. It will not, however, consider the merits of that decision. And we have requested an interview with Creative Australia's CEO, Adrian Collette, but we haven't received a response at the time of recording.
Now, there's been some movements in the dispute between the concert pianist, Jason Gillam, and the Melbourne Symphony Orchestra.
Yeah, a quick flashback. Last year, the MSO cancelled a concert featuring Jason Gillam after he spoke out on stage about the killing of Palestinian reporters in Gaza. That led Gillam to launch legal action against the MSO, claiming discrimination based on political beliefs. On Monday, the initial hearings in that case took place in court, where the MSO are attempting to have Gillam's case thrown out, arguing that he was a freelance employee and not a common law employee. The justice provided some pushback to the MSO's claims, but has reserved her decision at the time of recording. Away from the courtroom, the former chief executive of the MSO, Sophie Gallet, has settled privately with Mr. Gillam, although the details of that settlement are confidential.
And in the United States, the Kennedy Center remains at the heart of a clash between the arts community and the Trump administration.
It does. J.D. Vance, the vice president, received a loud reaction when he attended a concert by the National Symphony Orchestra at the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C. Vance was shown waving to the audience for roughly 30 seconds before the show, and the crowd spent that time loudly booing the vice president. The interim president of the center, Richard Grenell, who was appointed by the new board put in place by Donald Trump, sent an email to staff in response in which he said, "As the premier arts organization in the United States of America, we must work to make the Kennedy Center a place where everyone is welcome, and that intolerance towards people who are politically different is just as unacceptable as intolerance in other areas." And the irony of the email's embrace of diversity and inclusion was not lost on staff members, given the public statements by Donald Trump and his board in recent weeks. Speaking of that, President and Kennedy Center Chairman Trump visited the center this week, where he was quoted as stating that the building was in tremendous disrepair. Trump is also speaking to the board, where he put forward a resolution that would give him the power to hire and fire members of the committee that helps decide who receives the Kennedy Center honors each year, an award that had, until now, been selected without interference by the White House.
And what else do we need to know?
The New South Wales state government has declared 14 foundation events, throwing support behind festivals like Bluesfest, Vivid and the Tamworth Country Music Festival. That categorisation will allow the festivals to lock in three-year investment agreements with Destination New South Wales and will give them a more favourable regulatory environment. More details will arrive as those new agreements begin to roll out, I'm sure. The philanthropist Pamela Wall has pledged a $10 million gift to the Adelaide Festival Centre Foundation. It's the largest performing arts donation in South Australian history, and the funds are to be specifically dedicated to programming. The Nine newspapers are reporting that the North Byron Parklands, the site where Splendour in the Grass has been held for the last two decades, is being sold, and that the site has approvals in place for developing it into an ultra-luxury private estate, a wellness retreat, or a boutique eco-development. The festival has been on break the last couple of years, but I guess this means it will need a new home if and when it comes back.
It's just what we need in the end, Byron.
Over in the UK, the Tate Museum has become the latest cultural institution to announce significant job cuts, with approximately 7% of their workforce to be laid off. And attendance at UK museums has increased significantly in the last year, but it's still well below the numbers seen before the pandemic. And last year, the head of King George V was removed from a statue in the Botanic Gardens in Melbourne and vanished. The head has now turned up again at a concert by the Irish rap group Kneecap. Posting a picture to their Instagram account, the band said, "Some madman dropped by with a huge King George's head so he could hear a few tunes for our last Melbourne show. Allegedly, his head was cut off last year in the city. Anyways, he was put on stage for a few tunes and then whisked away. Remember, every colony can fall."
Sky, thanks.
Thanks, Daniel.
This is Arts in 30. You're with me, Daniel Browning. Last year, the film It Ends With Us launched to box office success and mixed critical response. And the film has become a huge part of cultural discourse, not for what happened on the screen, but what happened behind the scenes. In December last year, lead actress Blake Lively filed a complaint with the California Civil Rights Department, claiming that her co-star, Justin Baldoni, created a hostile work environment because of his inappropriate conduct. Claims and counterclaims have gone out between the two parties, including a $400 million civil lawsuit that Baldoni's filed against Lively. And an entire cottage industry has sprung up around the case on social media, including figures like far-right commentator Candace Owens. Which version of the story you see depends heavily on the algorithm you're linked to. But it's very apparent that the loudest voices are anti-Blake Lively. Kat Ten Barge, an independent journalist who writes at Spitfire News, has been investigating the story. Kat, welcome to Arts in 30. Let's start with the background. What did Blake Lively actually allege happened on the set with Justin Baldoni?
So Blake Lively alleged that on the set of the movie It Ends With Us, there was a pattern of behavior from Justin Baldoni, as well as another producer on the film, that constituted sexual harassment. And then she said on set, there was a confrontation that she arranged with the help of Sony, which was also producing and distributing the movie. And so during this confrontation, she alleged that Justin Baldoni and the other producer signed an agreement that they would cease and desist this harassing behavior.
And what's Baldoni claimed in response?
So Baldoni says that they only signed this agreement to basically keep the peace on set. He said that none of the behavior described in the agreement actually occurred. And he said that Blake Lively actually attempted to usurp this production and sort of take over as producer herself, despite that not being her role.
Why would you sign a cease and desist order, you know, on set, just to keep the peace? I mean, that kind of is a little confusing.
Exactly. And that's the argument that Blake Lively's lawyers are making, that they would not have put their names and signatures on an agreement detailing this behavior.
Now, the initial reporting on the story seemed to be firmly in Blake Lively's favor, given the allegations. But what's changed?
So after Blake Lively officially came forward with her allegations, she initially did so in a civil rights complaint in California, which was then immediately reported on by the New York Times, which had been investigating this behind the scenes. Now, within the few days of that New York Times expose article, the crowd and the response was largely in Blake Lively's favor. But soon afterwards, Justin Baldoni's lawyer began an aggressive media campaign, and Justin Baldoni sued Blake Lively himself for defamation, including his own exhibits and sort of releasing his own evidence along the way to the public. And it was sort of that rollout and that evidence that has made a huge impact in terms of the crowd of people online going back even harder in Justin Baldoni's defense and even harder against Blake Lively. Mm-hmm.
Truly the court of public opinion. Now, Lively is the biggest celebrity here with a husband that's far bigger yet again. Why does it still seem like she's come out with more damage to her reputation than Justin Baldoni?
There's a couple of different factors at play here. One of them is that Justin Baldoni actually has a very wealthy financial backer who he is part of the same religious community with. So he actually has a billionaire named Steve Sarowitz who is reportedly funding his lawsuit against Blake Lively, as well as the alleged retaliatory smear campaign that involved hiring these other figures like crisis publicists and social media people who would go in and plant narratives and skew the internet in favor of Baldoni and against Lively. So these all come together to form the basis of Blake Lively's allegations. Justin Baldoni's camp obviously disputes that those services were actually obtained or followed through on. But that's one reason why the internet may be so in favor of Baldoni versus Blake Lively, who is the larger celebrity with more household name recognition, with a longer career. And of course, her husband and one of her best friends are also both A-list celebrities. The other factor that I think is coming into play here that you see very clearly in the online discourse around the case is sort of this idea of misogyny that always sort of negatively impacts the woman, regardless of whether she's the smaller celebrity in the situation or the bigger celebrity. If, you know, Blake Lively were a smaller celebrity, people might say that she's trying to raise her profile with these allegations, which we often see in these cases. But because she's the bigger celebrity, people are positioning it as her using her power to crush Baldoni. And so regardless of who she is, he's perceived as the victim.
Now, you mentioned the kind of flood of information, the video, audio, text messages. There's a website that has timelines and documents. What is that flood of information intended to prove? This is from Baldoni's side.
Yes. So this flood of information coming out into the public is a bit of an extra judicial defense, meaning that he and his lawyer are not necessarily putting all of this information through the court system. They're taking it to the public instead. So there's a lower or really a non-existent burden of proof that what they're putting out there in the public is true. And what you actually see happening is the judge in the case has rebuked Baldoni's lawyer for doing this. He's also rebuked Blake Lively's team for their public statements, but the judge has specifically pointed to this mountain of Baldoni's evidence, and he said, you can't just put this on the docket. He referred to it as abusing the docket, and he said that there could be legal sanctions for Justin Baldoni's lawyer if he continues to try to do this. But in terms of how the public has responded to this mountain of information, it's been very, very successful in swinging the narrative back around in Baldoni's favor.
He isn't the only one flooding the internet with details. There are many commentators who are releasing daily updates on the case, all the people involved. Why is there such a deluge of content, and what's the impact of that constant commentary?
So the reason why there's so much content about this case online is because it is effective. And what I mean by that is when people post about this case, particularly and really only when they publish it through the lens of Justin Baldoni being in the right and Blake Lively being in the wrong, their content has a much higher likelihood of getting eyeballs on it, getting likes, getting shares, getting engagement. And of course, for a lot of these content creators, they are making quite a lot of money from doing this. And so that is a very, very big driving factor in what we're seeing online.
Now, they're very different cases, but the response towards Lively feels a bit to me reminiscent of what happened to Amber Heard in her case against her ex-husband Johnny Depp. That's not necessarily a coincidence, is it?
Absolutely. It is not a coincidence because some of the people who are on Justin Baldoni's team are the same people who were on Johnny Depp's team during that 2022 trial. And a lot of the people commenting on this case online with a very pro-Justin Baldoni, anti-Blake Lively spin were the same people who were driving a lot of the online conversation about the Johnny Depp case with a very anti-Amber Heard spin. And I think the consistent thematic narrative that we see playing out with these two cases is, although they are very different and the allegations are very different, the takeaway for a lot of these content creators and a lot of people in the audience is this idea of pushing back against the Me Too movement, really. And it's a lot of people undermining the idea that women should be believed by claiming that these women lied for their own gain.
Now, is Lively's camp attempting similar tactics to those being used by Baldoni?
I think that Lively's camp, you've seen in sort of the evidence in the court documentation and in the way that Lively's public representatives have spoken to the media, you do see some of the same tactics at play. So, for example, Lively has worked with a publicist who has a long history, similar to Justin Baldoni's publicists, of handling clients who are controversial, of having a very active role with the media, of engaging in this kind of access journalism. But you are seeing sort of a big market difference in how Justin Baldoni's lawyer is engaging with not only the press, but in certain situations, you have Justin Baldoni's lawyer actually going to his former clients, who include people who are big newscasters, big influencers, people with big online followings. And he's doing interviews with his former and current clients about his other client and creating this very like intense narrative that's being seeded online and then is going viral. So you're not seeing that from Blake Lively's camp as much. You're seeing more of the traditional press strategy, where with Baldoni's camp, you're seeing more of the new media, digital media influencer strategy.
Shock and awe. Now, this sort of campaign, the flood of information, the attempt to control the narrative, is most apparent during a high-profile court case like this. But is it something that's happening regularly behind the scenes? To what extent is public opinion being shaped by PR firms like this on the regular?
We have evidence to believe that a lot of PR sort of manipulation of public opinion is happening behind the scenes. And one of the things I looked at in my reporting on social media manipulation as it pertains to this case is just what exactly is possible and what is the landscape of what people can buy, what sorts of services they can seek out to try to manipulate public opinion through social media. And what I found is that many PR firms have advertised this type of social media manipulation and this type of public manipulation for almost a decade. So for over a decade, you have numerous PR firms around the world advertising that they can do this. Now, whether they actually can and how we can trace the actual impact of individual campaigns, that's evidence and data we don't yet have. So we know what these types of firms promise the ability to do. We do not know how effective they actually are. And that's something that the Blake Lively case hinges on as well, is that Justin Baldoni's argument is that the ultimate tide of opinion was organic and that they never actually put their social combat plan into play.
Thanks, Kat. That's Kat Ten Barge, an independent journalist. You can read more of her coverage on this story at spitfirenews.com, which you'll find linked on our show page. I'm Daniel Browning, and you're listening to Arts in 30, your weekly wrap of global news in arts and culture. Within the history of hip-hop in Australia, accent has very often been a flashpoint. Should Australian hip-hop artists be using American accents like their US antecedents did? Or should they use their own, despite the cultural cringe factor? The Music Show, with the help of their substantial archive, has just had a big look at how hip-hop has changed in Australia in its 30-something year lifespan. Here's Dr. Niall Edwards-Fitzsimons.
There was actually a long period where young Australians were engaging with hip-hop culture, but with the other parts of hip-hop culture. So we have the first breakdancers in Western Sydney, specifically in Bankstown, by about 1983 or 1984, and then they came into the CBD. And graffiti artists got started around then, and then in other cities around the nation as well. But the music actually lagged a little way behind. According to DJ Blaze, who was an important early hip-hop DJ in Australia, he said actually that rhyming was the most neglected part of the four quarters of hip-hop because all the rap that anyone had ever heard was from African-Americans. Most felt that they were the only ones who could do it properly and sound good. The problem was, in reality, that no one had ever heard a non-American accent rapping. And when they did hear an Australian voice rapping, they would turn off and prefer to hear someone with a fake accent. And he says that stifled the development of hip-hop as a music here to begin with.
So what's the first hip-hop record in Australia then?
Well, technically, it's a track called The Aussie Rap from 1983.
Ah, g'day. How you going?
And while this track might technically be the first Australian hip-hop release, it's not really something that anyone in the hip-hop community credits. It was actually made by a couple of comedians from Sydney, and it's much more sort of a novelty or a parody track. And I think it works as a parody because, as we heard, hearing an Australian rapping was just so strange and silly to people at the time. And it's no wonder I'm your average Aussie, I'm one of the blokes. Well, I like my beer and I like my smoke. I'm your average Aussie, just one of the mob. I'm not a doctor and I'm not a slob. Bob's me up, Duncan's me mate. I'm your average Aussie and I feel great. So you can hear there, it takes the format of hip-hop and the rapping, but it doesn't really engage at all with the subject matter and perspectives that had been found in hip-hop up to that point. Obviously, hip-hop, as we said, is very much associated with the African-American experience in America, and key lyrical themes usually include oppression and the struggle to survive. So this track was widely panned by early hip-hop heads in Australia, and it had little impact. But funnily enough, we'll see that this over-the-top Aussie larrikin persona that we can hear on that track and the broad accent, it would actually come back and come to dominate the local scene a couple of decades later.
So obviously it won't be authentically Australian if it's dealing with the experience of African Americans. So what is the first authentic hip-hop record about?
True. Well, I mean, the first record that is seen by members of the community as, you know, the first real Australian hip-hop release, it is very American in its delivery and subject matter. So it's not really an authentic representation of Australian life, but it was the starting point for what the hip-hop community at the time felt was their music. And I'm talking about a 1988 compilation record called Down Under by Law. DJ Blaze, who I mentioned before, actually described this record as very poor and a tub of lard. And the tracks all very clearly show their American influences. But for an example, we can listen to MC Spice on the record she's credited as Charlene, and she's one of the first female MCs in Australia. She was only 15 when she wrote and recorded this track, Hardcore Love, and in the years since, she's actually come to hate it. She says it's really corny, but it was a milestone nonetheless.
So we're in the late 80s, early 90s. Would you say there was much of a hip-hop scene locally?
I think at that stage there definitely was, and it was really tight-knit, really diverse and really energetic, but it was also very small and underground, very hard to find. We can actually hear MC Bliss from the duo Bliss and Esso on the music show in 2015, reflecting on what he found here when he arrived as a teenager from America in the early 90s.
So I grew up in the States in D.C., in just outside in Alexandria, Virginia, and there, I guess, hip-hop was quite prominent, you know, and I would hear it all the time on the radio, and I just kind of fell in love with it through the radio. And my first element of hip-hop was actually beatboxing, so the and that was kind of my first element. And then what happened was my folks moved the family to Sydney, And I kind of arrived, you know, this little teenager that loved hip hop music. I rocked up at school the first day and I'm kind of like, we're all the hip hop fans. And no one knew what it was. I mean, it was that tiny
so
in Australia.
What year is this?
This would have been early 90s, about 93, I think. Yeah. So it was to the level you go into a store and you'd be lucky to find one hip hop record. It was very, very underground. And in terms of like local artists, there was hardly any. And certainly that we didn't know.
That's Bliss from Bliss and Esso and Andy Ford in conversation with Dr. Niall Edwards Fitzsimons. And that episode of The Music Show was produced by our music correspondent this week, Ellie Parnell. Ellie, what is our track of the week?
Hi, Daniel. Hey. I hope you've got some dancing shoes on.
I can put them on.
This is going to put a pep in your step. We've got the track Wrong by Annie and the Caldwells, a family band from West Point, Mississippi. It is, it's phenomenally uplifting. You can sort of dance to it at church or at the club. It sort of goes both ways.
Church or club.
Yeah. Their music is so rooted in their sort of spirituality, but it's just got absolutely beautiful disco and soul beats. It's just joyful. This family band, and it is a true family band. We've got Annie out front. Her husband of 50 years is playing guitar here, and then their kids on backing vocals, drums and bass. So it's a true family affair.
Well, I mean, you've given it such a rap. Can you throw to our track of the week?
Sure. So yeah, it's called Wrong and it's from the album Can't Lose My Soul, which is coming out this Friday. They're coming to Australia in June. I think it's something that you want to get on down to. It's pure talent. This was recorded in a church with a mobile recording studio set up. I feel like you can kind of hear that in the recording. You can hear that they're family, there's chemistry. It's a bit raw, but it's absolutely joyful. This track is called Wrong by Annie and the Caldwells.
That was Wrong by Annie and the Caldwells, our track of the week, chosen by our music correspondent, Ellie Parnell. And that's all we have time for today. But remember, you can listen back whenever you want on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. Arts in 30 is produced by Sky Kirkham. C. Benedict is our executive producer. Riley Mellis is our sound engineer. I'm Daniel Browning, and I'll catch you next time on Arts in 30.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.